think one of the legislation has defined what indigenous law means, and that is found in the Law of Evidence Amendment Act, which basically stated that in section 1, sub 4, indigenous is restricted to the definition of indigenous law to the law or custom as applied by the black tribes in the Republic. The argument may be, if one follows that, is that the Khoisan people may be arguing that they are not blacks or they are not falling within the groups known as African tribes. However, Chairperson, that was a 1988 Act, and that was before the Constitution came into shape and form. Chairperson, from where we are standing today and the jurisprudence that has sought to provide the provision and moving forward and government policy, it is clear that there is recognition of traditional authorities. Furthermore, since we have a democratic country with the public representatives that are democratically elected, traditional leadership is a hereditary form of authority, and therefore it is not elected. However, with that being said, in terms of government policy, in relation to how we are influenced and involve the traditional authorities, they are afforded an advisory and influential role to the democratic structure. And to be specific, in the Constitution in Chapter 12 places their involvement and their crucial participation at local level. Chairperson, for the second part of the legal question, which is requesting that there be a department that deals with indigenous affairs in respect of the Khoisan, in terms of the Public Service Act and looking how Section 91 is structured of the Constitution, it is a prerogative of the President to establish and to name the department. With that legal framework, Chairperson, our advice is as follows. Like I've said, the Public Service Act, as well as the Constitution, has given a broader empowerment to the President and the prerogative to decide on which department is necessary to establish, and once that decision has been made, such a department must be proclaimed in the Government Gazette according to that specific decision the President has made. Furthermore, Chapter 12, Sections 30 and 31, read with Sections 9 and 235 of the Constitution, they are allowing for self-determination as well as recognition of customary practices and customary institutions. In light of what we have indicated, Chairperson, as well as understanding that Parliament is currently busy processing legislation that eventually, if it is passed by both Houses of Parliament, because it's a Section 76 bill, and that bill is called the Traditional and Khoisan Bill. Traditional and Khoisan Leadership Bill. It's going to be an act once enacted, and we do admit or indicate that in the Traditional Framework Act, which the courts have said that is the act that Chapter 12 required, there was maybe an oversight on part of Parliament or part of the executive that introduced those bills before they were law, that an expressed recognition of the Khoisan was not expressly and explicitly written in the Traditional Framework Act. However, the Traditional and Khoisan Bill that will speak to traditional leadership in terms of the jurisprudence and interpretation that the courts have given, that Chapter 12 is drafted, it was to include every other form of traditional authority without being specific and detailed, because the detail, as indicated in Chapter 12, is supposed to come from national legislation. And as I understand, Parliament is, at this present moment, through legislative processes, working through the bill that is definitely going to recognize the Khoisan nations, as well as provide every other input that is required and necessary in terms of what is not clear and what is ambiguous right now. Therefore, Chairperson, in my respectful view and advice on how to move forward on this submission, it is clear that the issue does not lie with the Constitution, but the issue was elsewhere in terms of legislation. And Parliament has taken the position to say that needs to be corrected, and that is why there is a legislative instrument that seeks to talk to that. And as soon as that process is over, I am assuring the committee that all these concerns that are raised here, they will definitely, in completeness and in its entirety, be covered in the traditional and coercant traditional authority bill. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Siyabonga Mahlovu. Honourable members, quite a legal one, and Honourable Bumlwana, there is no other on this one. It couldn't be any other. Honourable Bumlwana and Honourable Mutapo, is that order?
Yes, I think that to do the normal and say whether the any questions we have from the legal gurus, if we do have any questions, but I have no questions to ask them, and I just want to comment and say thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Bumlwana. Honourable Mutapo?
Okay, thank you, Chairperson, Honourable colleagues, and our legal guru, to Bongo, Honorable Bumla and Lingo. I'm happy today she started first. Chairperson, thanks so much for this warm reception and also the certain case. It's true that we tried to cover it, especially in item 26, the last one. Where it relates to traditional and coastal leadership being. And even when you go down to provinces, except Western Cape, of course, has got all the corporate governance and traditional leadership, traditional authorities department. In my province, it's corporate governance and human settlement and traditional affairs. So what I'm trying to say is that note, but I'm happy clarity is clearly articulated, Chairperson.
No, thanks, Honourable Mutapo. Just one small one, Ms. Gemma, is section, chapter 12, then of the Constitution. Are you saying that it doesn't list the communities, the national communities, traditional communities?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chapter 12, as you have put in your question, it does not provide the details, but it says traditional authorities and traditional institutions are recognized. However, their status and role and functions is left out to be outlined in the national legislation. And that is why I made reference to the Legislative Framework Act, to the Traditional Leaders Framework Act, and as I indicated, that act is, with the bill that is before Parliament currently, is going to be repealed in its entirety. It's not an amendment, it's going to be a repeal, because it's then re-looking at all the provisions of that Framework Act, and it's also now specifically making proper reference to the coastline nations, but there is no specific expression or detail of each nation that is to be termed traditional nation or traditional authority that is mentioned in the Constitution. The Constitution gave it in broader expressed term of William Jefferson. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. And there be no further views and reactions from the members, we then thank you for your well worked out presentation, and it really serves as a legal guide to the submission. And then as and when we then consider the submission, it will indeed be of value to us. Thank you very much, Ms. Ngema. We're moving to the second one. The second one is, in terms of that reference, is 1656. And it's section 28. And we are having a new presenter. Welcome. It's, let me pronounce it properly, Omoti Beit, right? Yeah. So, welcome. Welcome, Sisi, and over to you.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning to everyone. My name is Tapangidi Beit. I'm in Internet Parliament Legal Services. So we received a request to advise on the submission by Greenhearts, who are proposing review and amendment of Section 28.1D of the Constitution. The submission argues that presently Section 28.1D of the Constitution does not protect children when it comes to abuse and degradation through child pornography. The second part of the submission states that not only manufacturing but also the possession and distribution of child pornography images should at least be considered a Schedule 5 or 6 crime and not a violation of the Publications Act only. I'll deal with the first part of the submission in terms of the legal framework. The Constitution explicitly addresses the rights of children and affords them specific protection in Section 28.1D. Section 28.1D states that every child has the right to be protected from maltreatment, neglect, abuse, or degradation. Although the Constitution does not define these terms, the definition of these terms are encapsulated in various sources. The simple and ordinary meanings of these terms can be found in the dictionary. The Children's Act also gives effect to Section 28.1D of the Constitution, and it defines abuse and neglect. The first case in SA that pronounced on child pornography is Derek versus Director of Public Prosecutions. Regarding degradation and abuse, the court held that degradation of children through child pornography is a serious harm which impairs their dignity and contributes to a culture which devalues their worth. There is obvious physical harm suffered by the victims of sexual abuse and by those children forced yield to the demands of pedophile and pornographer. The harm of child abuse is real and ongoing, and the state is under a constitutional obligation to combat it. It should not be overlooked that many of the resultant acts of abuse against children take place in private. It is clear from this case that the Constitutional Court has recognized that degradation and abuse can take the form of child pornography, and the terms also fall within the ambit of what constitutes degradation and abuse. Therefore, it is our view that the terms abuse and degradation under Section 28.1D of the Constitution encapsulates child pornography, and Section 28.1D requires no further amendments to specifically list child pornography. Moving on to the second part of the submission, which requires that not only manufacturing but also the possession and distribution of child pornography images be a Schedule 5 or 6 crime. Child pornography is criminalized under the Criminal Law Sexual Offences Act as well as the Films and Publications Act. In terms of the Sexual Offences Act, the Act makes the exposure or display of child pornography to adults, the sexual exploitation of children, the sexual grooming of children, and the use of children for child pornography offences. With regards to the nature of the punishment for the mentioned offences, the Sexual Offences Act is silent, but in Section 56A of the Act makes reference to Section 276 of the Criminal Procedure Act. Section 24B of the Films and Publications Act prohibits and creates offences for the possession, manufacturing, and distribution of films, games, and publications related to child pornography. No specific penalty is mentioned for the transgression of Section 24B of the Act, but this has currently been addressed in the in clause 25 of the Films and Publications Amendment Bill. Offences relating to child pornography are found in the Sexual Offences Act and Films and Publications Bill. The submission and disregard does not require constitutional amendment. However, the committee may consider referring this part of the submission to the relevant portfolio committee for further consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Sapang. Honourable members, any takers? Right. Romulan, you find there's no other on this one as well.
Silence means consent.
Oh, silence is called. They used to say so. Yeah. Eh? Sometimes we are confused. Oh, it's too. Or the content is too deep.
Yeah.
Pro. All right. Okay. Thanks, honourable members. Thank you, Tabang. You see, that comes from an intern. That's the quality. We must appreciate that. It sounds. It reads quality. We thank you for that input. Being an intern, that's good work. Thanks. It will indeed help us. As a guiding document as and when we reach that stage of considering the deliberating on the submission itself. Thank you. We're moving to the third one. Reference is 141 from the Constitutional and Legal Service Office. And then our reference is C58. And the presenter there is Fatima. She's been with us quite a while. She's done, is that probably a third, is this your third one? Eh? Yeah. Thanks, Fatima. Over to you.
Good morning, or good afternoon at least, Chair and Honourable Members. The submission that I'm dealing with is by Mr. Bekinkosi Michael Mtolo, who notes that he is the Greater Kokstad Deputy Mayor, but is writing the submission in his personal capacity. Chair, this submission consists of two separate parts, and I'll deal with each one separately. The first is in relation to Section 217 of the Constitution, which deals with public procurement. And here, Mr. Mtolo is proposing that the section be amended to provide specifically for the upliftment of black people in general and black African people in particular. In this regard, he proposes that the state be empowered to set procurement targets that seek to benefit only black people in general and Africans in particular. He also proposes further that Parliament be directed to develop national legislation to realise these objectives. Members will no doubt be aware that Section 217 of the Constitution states that when an organ of state in national, provincial or the local sphere of government procures, it must do so in accordance with a system which is fair, equitable, transparent, competitive and cost effective. It further states that the state must implement a procurement policy that will provide for categories of preference in the allocation of contracts and the protection or advancement of persons or categories of persons disadvantaged by unfair discrimination. That therefore speaks to this issue of procurement being equitable. The framework finds expression in the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act, which gives effect to the conditions in Section 217. In terms of this act, preference points can be given for functionality, price, and reconstruction development program goals. It also provides that certain points will be allocated to tenderers who are historically disadvantaged by unfair discrimination on the basis of race, gender, or disability. In January 2017, so just earlier this year, new regulations were promulgated in terms of the PPPFA, and these revised regulations are aimed at mirroring or speaking at least to the codes of good practice in terms of the BBBEE, which is the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act, which act now speaks specifically to the legacy of apartheid policies and tries to redress the economic non-participation of black people in the economy. So these regulations are quite far-reaching. Two of the main things that the new regulations do is, one, they make subcontracting compulsory where feasible for contracts above 30 million rand. A minimum of 30% of the value of the contract must be subcontracted to specifically designated groups. And then secondly, tenders may include pre-qualification criteria to advance designated groups by stipulating that tenderers who do not form part of such group are disqualified from tendering completely, so they won't even enter the race, as it were. The term designated groups is defined as including unemployed black people not attending and not required by law to attend an educational institution, black people who are youth, as defined in the National Youth Commission Act, black people who are persons with disabilities, as defined in the Code of Good Practice issued in terms of the Employment Equity Act, black people living in the rural and underdeveloped areas, as well as black military veterans who meet the definition of a military veteran in terms of the Military Veterans Act. So it's clear from the above that what the submitter is seeking to achieve is in fact quite thoroughly dealt with in existing legislation. I think that the issue here may have arisen because the submission was given to us in 2016 and these regulations are 2017 regulations. So it seems that most of the issues are in fact covered. The only one that isn't covered is the request that emphasis be placed on black African people over and above other black people. But even there, Chair, there's nothing in Section 217 as it's currently drafted that would prevent the advancement of black Africans in particular as a group over any other black people, which is now defined as including Indians and colored persons. There's no reason why the BBBE Act cannot be amended to distinguish, therefore, between categories of black people. And if the committee wishes to consider that, that can be sent to the relevant portfolio committee to consider. But certainly, in my view, the Constitution doesn't require an amendment because what Mr. Mtolo seeks, which is a procurement system that is designed in a manner that does not favour established monopolies and which promotes the historically disadvantaged, is in fact already what legislation and Section 217, I think, provides for. Thank you, Chair. That's the first issue.
Right. Any reactions, inputs, clarity, members? Good. Honourable Bumla.
Yeah, I just want to ask, are you through with the whole, or with only this
one aspect?
Oh, one aspect. Procurement. Are you saying, lady, that so far there are legislation that are covering what Mr. Dolo wanted? Are those legislation in terms of provision? Present provisions of the Constitution, and or if what Mtolo requires won't it strengthen those legislation? I'm trying to get it. It seems to me to think that it would have been correct for Mr. Mtolo if this legislation had not been enacted. Now that they have been enacted, you're saying we don't need. That's the question. Are you saying that? Yeah, you got the question. Thank you.
Yeah, it's quite clear, Honourable Bumla. Fatima?
Chair, in my view, 217 is quite adequate. It speaks to equity, and equity may change. It may be that in years to come, there is a different group of people that are more disadvantaged, and that you may then want to have legislation that deals particularly, or to allow for preference points, particularly for those groups. At present, the law that allows you to allocate preference points based on different categories. It is there. Whether that law needs to be changed to make it compulsory that certain groups are, or black African people in particular, should be granted more points in terms of the preference point system than other black people is something that can be considered. But I don't think that that necessitates a change to 217, which is in fact quite progressive. Worldwide, you won't generally find a procurement-related clause in a constitution at all. So this, in my view, is already a very progressive section, and I don't think that it's necessary for any change to happen here. But as I said, if there is a consideration as to whether the necessary legislation must maybe be amended, that can be considered by the committee further. But it must be done so in light of the new regulations that have just been published in January. So to date, it's been quite a short space of time to allow those regulations to actually, for us to actually get a sense of how it will play out. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Fatima. I think we move to the next aspect.
Chair, the next one is on section 25.2, which deals with the expropriation of property. Section 25.2 empowers the state to expropriate land in terms of law of general application for a public purpose. It further provides that expropriation is subject to the payment of compensation, the amount of which must be agreed to by those affected, or if they can't agree, then decided or approved by a court. The submitter, Chair, asks that this clause be amended to provide that the valuer general will have the power, in the absence of an agreement by the parties, to determine the compensation price for expropriated land, and that such decision of the valuer general must be final and binding. The Office of the Valuer General was established in terms of the Property Valuation Act 2014, so it's a fairly new office. Section 12 of the Act mandates the Valuer General to determine the value of property identified for land reform, having regard to prescribed criteria, procedures and guidelines. At present, there are draft regulations which set out the formula for calculation of compensation, but these have not yet been promulgated. The Constitution does not provide that a particular office is responsible for determining the value of compensation, nor does it require that a valuer general be appointed. Implicit, I think, in Mr. Mtolo's proposal is that the Office of the Valuer General be afforded constitutional status, with the effect that a valuation by the valuer general will be final and binding. However, Chair, whether the determination by the valuer general is stated in the Constitution as being a final and binding determination, it must be noted that that decision will be an administrative decision. The decision to determine a compensation amount, like a decision to award a tender, grant a permit, or issue a license, has clear legal consequences that affect rights. This decision can therefore ultimately be reviewed by a court and either confirmed, varied, or set aside. And therefore, in practice, it can never be final and binding unless it's accepted by the affected person. What should rather be considered then, I think, is whether the status of the Office of the Valuer General be afforded constitutional status. Because I'm not sure if that will seek to achieve what the submitter is asking for. So in my view, Chair, that is something that the committee can consider, whether the Constitution, that section on expropriation, be amended to provide that the Valuer General can determine the amount where there's a dispute instead of a court determining an amount, because currently it's a court that determines the amount where there's a dispute. However, it must be noted that the second part of the submission that says it must be final and binding, that won't stand because it will be an administrative decision for purposes of law. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable members, clarity input on the legal opinion, Office of the Valuer General to be accorded constitutional status. Honourable Self, welcome.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. I just want to know what implication there would be in effect if the Office of the Valuer General was recognised constitutionally. I mean, unless there are certain powers and functions that are attached in the Constitution, presumably the mere recognition of that office would have no effect.
Yeah, let's take one more boom run as well.
I'm not sure, but you know, I'm not inviting an argument on this. I know it will be discussed later. It removes the power of the courts. I don't think by putting it in the bylaw, it actually strengthens.
Both. If we include it, then it means that when it goes on review, what the court will be testing is the rationality of the decision of the valuer general. So this is why I say that I think that issue should still be considered. The second part of the proposed wording, because the wording here says, subject to compensation, the amount of which and the time and manner of payment of which have either been agreed to by those affected or if not agreed to by those affected, and this is the part that's now added, decided by the valuer general, whose decision shall be final and binding. So I do indeed agree that we must consider whether the valuer general's status must be lifted and included in the constitution over here, but the second part of the sentence, which deals with the decision being final and binding, that you wouldn't need to put in the constitution, because in any case that would be subject to a review. So I do think it is an issue that will affect our understanding, notwithstanding that there is legislation dealing with it, but it will affect the party who then has the status of the office of the valuer general. Because at present, even if legislation is going to provide that the valuer general must determine the price, the Constitution is still saying you go to court to determine the price where there's a dispute. So indeed, if we add the valuer general, it will take the courts out of that equation. It will mean that the valuer general will follow the proposed formulas that are going to be adopted once they do. But it's only the second part that I'm saying in terms of the final and binding that is not correct. So, Chair, what I am indeed saying is that we must consider whether the valuer general must be included, whether it must be given that status.
Thank you very much.
I just want to ask one question
from the I thought there is also another proposal relating to this that is legal to consider. Is that not correct? Where somebody was saying that there should be compensation, without compensation, take the transfer of land without compensation. Was there not such a
There is one that we've received a legal opinion on that relates to this one, but I guess the emphasis is not the same in what is being requested. There's slight difference, but it's still coming as a full submission, but we did receive a legal opinion on that one in the previous meeting.
Yeah.
All right. Honourable Swart.
Chair, I was just going to refresh our memory because I remember we had a discussion on that issue. And I don't know if it was finalised, but the members indicated that that had already, it had already been a debate in the House on the issue of expropriation of land without compensation. So there was a little debate amongst us.
Yes.
So the matter is definitely before us,
yeah.
Advocate of Pawana.
Honourable Mwabe?
Thanks, Papata. Just one question for clarity, ma'am. On the same issue of the Velo General, if we opt to give it the constitutional recognition status, will we not be making it to be seen as one of the Chapter 9 institutions? And the reason why I'm asking is because obviously there will be some other things to be followed. And the issue of land, yes, it's the only issue. But now once we make the chapter 9 institution, maybe it might not be the permanent issue that that comes up now and then when it is addressed properly. It's just a clarity-seeking question.
I'll just add to that as well, Chair.
All right.
How does the criteria for deciding what bodies should be Chapter 9 institutions was done during the constitutional negotiation phase? What one then would have to think about, what criteria would one use now to add to that, and what impact that would have on the weighting that was considered in the certification judgment when the constitution was valued against the constitutional principles. We've got various institutions. You've got the Accountant General, for example. Why would you have the Surveyor General and not the Accountant General? Land is a very emotive issue. So these are policy issues one has to weigh up if one does. There'd have to be a very strong motivation to lift the Surveyor General to that level of a Chapter 9 institution. There are other bodies that are coming, but even in that Chapter 9 of the Constitution, there are different weighting of those bodies as well. So it's something that one needs to approach with great caution. I'm not expressing a view either way on it, but I think one's got to approach it with a lot of caution.
Fatima?
Gee, I don't think that there's a legal answer as to whether if there's recognition, whether it will fall into Chapter 9 as one of those Chapter 9 institutions, or if it will be dealt with separately somehow. There are other offices that are meant, that are referred to in the Constitution, for example, the National Director of Public Prosecution, but those officials don't find expression in Chapter 9. So these are all policy issues that we would need to seriously consider. But definitely there would need to be regard had as to what the status is going to be, how we would inform who the person is that gets appointed as a Valuer General and so on. A lot of that is covered at the moment presently in the Act, but depending on whether we add this to the expropriation section, we'd also have to consider whether there would be any other role for the Valuer General outside of that to warrant the status of the other Chapter 9 institutions.
I think the trend is just to listen and require certain technical questions from them. These are not the trend. So in other words, we're just asking for clarity, seeking questions. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Are you done?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Thank you, Ms. Ibrahim. That concludes your submission, right? The legal opinion. Thank you very much for your help. It's food for thought. I'm sure we're going to have a good debate when we deal with the with that submission. Yeah. Thank you very much for your help. And honourable members, we move to the two from Dr. Lutz. Section 9, you know, it's one of the most asked section to be amended in this submission, it looks like, to me. There's quite a number on those. That's 142 in terms of the Constitution and Legal Service Office reference, 142, 2017, and then ours is 1660. Dr. Lutz.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, Chairperson. Good afternoon, members. Chair, with your permission, I have a second one as well to present, which is 126 of 2017 on our reference. If I could beg the committee's permission to first deal with that one, as it speaks to the electoral system, which has been the theme that I've been bringing to the committee in the last few meetings. This will be the last submission that we have on our list for electoral system, so that will then wrap up that issue. And then, as Chairperson has mentioned, Section 9 is always a very interesting question. That will then be the submission that I have that is more voluminous. So with permission, if I may deal with the shorter electoral one first.
Yeah, get something around.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, then the last aspect of the electoral system that has been brought to the committee's attention through the 2016 submissions is one by
1635 members. We're all there, right?
One, yeah, number 126 of 2017, our reference, Chair, and number 1635 of the committee's reference.
Right. It's the last one. All right, Dr. Lutz.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, Mr. Martins refers to Section 86 of the Constitution, which speaks to the election of the President, and then he makes a statement that there needs to be, or the Constitution needs to sever the power between the legislature and the executive. That section of the election of the President doesn't necessarily speak to the interaction between the executive and the legislature, but it places the President in power, and then I think that needs to be pulled through to the election of cabinet, because that's where the separation of powers comes into the executive and the legislature. So that then is Section 91, which gives the President the power to elect ministers from members in the National Assembly. And that, if one looks at Mr. Martin's submission, is his concern, that how can you have an executive, which is also part of the legislature, there needs to be a separation of powers, because the Constitution is built on the doctrine of separation of powers, amongst other doctrines. The Constitutional Court actually dealt with this specific conundrum in the certification case, stating that there is no universal model of separation of powers, and there is also no such thing as absolute separation when it comes to government structures. We have our three arms, and yes, they each have a mandate, but there's no absolute separation. It's more a functional separation, and it's for that reason, to keep the balance, that the Constitution gives checks and balances powers to each arm. So, for instance, just to give a practical example, the President and the Ministers are called to the National Assembly to respond to questions. That would be a form of a check through oversight. The Ministers, even though members of the National Assembly, are not members of the committees which perform the oversight functions and to which they then report. So the functional separation is there. In that essence, just to sum it up, although Mr. Martin may not see that clear separation in the wording of the Constitution, the Constitutional Court has given it an interpretation that puts it in the frame of the doctrine of separation of powers. So where he's saying that the 86 and then obviously by implication 91 goes against the separation of power, it is actually falling within the definition that the Constitutional Court has granted. So with that then, Chairperson, it's our office's opinion that there is nothing wrong, there's no infringement on the separation of power, given that there is this exercise of checks and balances. It is obviously for Parliament, if there is a need to enhance checks and balances or to change that system, that then is a policy decision that will have to be taken. But in its current format, there is no conflict with the doctrine of separation of powers. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable members, puts clarity.
No.
All right, so you've overindulged on this one, on the electoral system. All right. Till the later stage when we get to the submission. We thank you, Dr. Lutz, on that one. So we're returning to Section 9, that subject. With that reference, 1660, and it's 142.17 in terms of your office reference. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee Members. Chair, yes, this submission was actually a very interesting one to deal with because it delves into an area of law and policy that is still very much in a developmental phase. Initially, it seems like a first read of the submission seems like a very easy question to answer. The submitter is referencing Section 9, along with the right to life and dignity and expression and the right of occupation, amongst others, and then drawing that all together and saying that there is an underpinning value of human dignity in the Constitution. But there is also a growing inequality, and specifically structural inequalities. And then the submitter gives the example of households that are run by women or men, whoever is running the household on a day-to-day basis for their family. But that, so that person is performing an occupation, but not getting equal recognition or pay for performing that occupation as running the household. That's where the equality comes in. But then reading further and delving further into what the submitter is actually asking, she makes reference to, or then presents a possible solution. And the solution that is presented in the submission is termed a basic income grant. And that then led me to doing further research. What would a basic income grant be called, how, what would it include, and she's requesting Parliament to consider looking at the basic income grants to address such structural inequalities, because her argument is the Constitution does encourage change. The Constitution does indeed, as I said in previous opinions, is a living document, it is adaptable to social change. So that argument of her, I can't fault, that's true. Basic income grant, however, has become an international debating point, and taking heed of the committee's request for us to look at various countries and not just America and the UK, I then delved even further and found that there are both socialist and capitalist arguments in favor of a basic income grant, because what it does is it takes away the means test and says it's a universal grant. You get it regardless of its means. That then is where the debate starts, because how do you determine who gets it if you don't have a means test? And this is really, I must say, an area where a specialist will have to come in and help determine impact from a policy perspective. It's not a legal question. But the structure of how you then give an individual instead of a household a grant. So the person who is doing the work will get a grant regardless of any means. It's just because they are there and they are doing it that specific or in that specific capacity. There's no clear definition. People call it an unconditional basic income. It's been referred to as universal basic income. It's been referred to as various concepts, but basically also termed a social dividend that is given. The basic income grant will come for example, or one example that was proposed in this debate, in these debates, is that public-owned enterprises, when the profits from public-owned enterprises can then be turned into a communal fund for a country, and from that communal fund as social dividends, that can then be distributed as a basic income grant to the citizens of a country. But that's really breaking it down very simplistically. I don't have the economic know-how to go into the policy issues, but I can highlight that advocates in favor of a basic income grant says that it allows for transparent welfare system and it promotes economic growth, while on the contrary, there's a caution from the other side, from proponents saying we need to like just look at it in more detail before saying yes to something so vague and so general without having a means test linking to a payment of a grant, saying you must weigh up social policy against economic policy, and also then warning that it carries the risk of being a disincentive for people to also look for employment. So those are all issues in the debate where I can't comment on the degree or the how much those should weigh. But what I can say in Brazil, what the World Bank has called Brazil's quiet revolution is they call it the Bolsa Familia program. Unlike the individual grant or the basic income grant that's going to an individual, the Bolsa Familia program goes to a household. So that may address issues that the submitter is raising, that there's a household and there's a job being done, but there's no pay being given for that job. So that is one aspect, but it doesn't fall completely within the basic income grant's general understanding or scope. And then there are countries that are doing pilot projects, but they're doing it with limited number of people. There's one in Barcelona that's running for 1,000 families with EU support. Then Finland is also trying it on a small scale, and there's a reference of Holland trying it in Utrecht. So none of these countries have answers or have an idea of what the impact should be or how to structure it, how to formulate it. So everybody is playing with the ideas, debating the idea that you should have this basic income grant, but there is no solid, I want to say, puzzle or structure or guidelines. So it is a very, very broad issue that the submitter is bringing. She is bringing it based on structural inequities that she is experiencing. This is not a what she's requesting from the basic economic grant consideration is not a constitutional amendment. It is a pure policy one. And it's one that also must be then considered in a certain fiscal structure of a country. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable members, Honourable Self.
Yes, Chair, I find the explanation fascinating. I've also done some work on basic income grants. It may very well have its place, but I think I agree with you and with the opinion that it doesn't belong in the Constitution, and therefore we ought not to be seized with it in this committee.
Honourable
Thank you, Chair. I remember last time when I was in this meeting, this court was told that we do not discuss anything, we just note and pass. But some of the submissions are really interesting to engage. I will limit myself to questions for clarity. I think I will agree on your opinion, but I also want to note that currently the government is doing all its best to reduce the dependent on in social grants. We've got about 17 million. Now, should we regulate the submission that has been given to us? Will we not be creating a welfare state even more than what is happening now, in your own opinion? Thank you.
Yeah. Dr. Lutz, you can give responses as you conclude. Honorable Bublan.
Yeah. Something similar to the door in Bridget. Is that not something similar to that? You're getting paid or what? Yeah, there are people who stay there and they keep on getting money from all the work. I take the point, but I'm not sure if we have not covered the question that is part of the basic human rights of the subject. So do you think that it's covered then? Indirectly or not necessarily in my very specific. So in other words, I thought perhaps you would it's part of human dignity to have what your basic rights in it. However, it's not a bad answer, so we want to spend out that it's done with that money. So if that is the case, I see you're not.
Dr. Lutz?
Thank you, Chair. With regard to the question whether the structure wouldn't create more dependence and the country is trying to empower, if I understand the question correctly, the country is trying to, as a policy stance, empower people rather than creating a dependence. That is a huge part of the debate. In the documents that I read, and that is the counter argument, is shouldn't countries be putting structures in place to empower people rather to stand on their own than to expand the grant system. So that is very much one of the arguments in that policy debate, and that's also where a country's general policy structure and where the country sees itself in strategic development will influence whether a basic grant income will fit into a specific country's way of assisting the citizens. So I have no specific answer except to say that that is indeed a valid debating point that is being considered internationally. Then with regard to the UK, there is a I don't know what they call it now, but it's linked to the number of children that you have. If you and that specifically came out now again, seeing as the Prince William and his wife expecting a third child, and the UK, the citizens were very, very upset because you only get government grants if you have two kids, but for the third one you won't. So it works through that system. So there has been that argument in the UK that people have two kids because then they're government subsidised and don't have to work. That then falls into the same argument of are you disempowering and creating a disincentive to find employment, or are you empowering because there's a person that needs to uphold the household and needs money to care for the people in the household? So that then also falls into the policy debate. Then with regard to human dignity, I think that's why Section 27 speaks of social security. So in a manner, I do agree that human dignity plays a role in placing people in a position where they feel they can support their families, they feel they can support themselves, and that then inherently if you feel in control of your situation and your environment, then you feel better about yourself, and that human dignity is empowering goes not just to the money, empowering goes also into the person. So yes, human dignity is there. And then Section 27, when it comes to social security, acknowledges that the social security that a country gives its citizens, or our citizens, is a progressive right. So it's something that's progressively realized. And for a country to decide what's the reasonable means and what's the policy constraints It's not a right that says everybody must get without a means test. That's not what our social security system says. It says it's something that there must be reasonable measures put in place with available resources. So where the basic income is, the income grant is one without a means test. It's one that you just get because you say you are in that position. Our Section 27 that gives social grants that then links into the human dignity element says within reasonable resources. So just my reading of that then will say how do you determine reasonable resources? You will have to have some sort of guideline and some sort of means test to determine who is most in need to then uplift, and then progressively as you can get more money and more resources, expand that. And that then perhaps links into the social dividend issue that the basic income grant debate has brought in, that when there's a public enterprise or a public-owned enterprise that makes profit, that it has an excess, so that can then go into a pool that is communal, and that can then feed into social grants or grants and structures. But Chair, I must admit that when I started delving, and as the Honourable Members have said, this is quite a tricky one. I find myself, like they say, treading water. this is very much a political and economic realm issue, and a lawyer feels slightly insecure. Well, this lawyer feels slightly insecure in commenting on more detail. With your permission, Chair.
Dr. Lutz, we indeed thank you, and you've gone quite deeper than what we asked, legal opinion, and I think it helps. It helps members, they will clear their minds. And Honourable Ncwaba, I know this, it keeps occupying you, this thing, that this exercise might not be, you know, what you expect. But we considered submissions before we requested the legal opinions as easy guide and reference when we engage and deliberate for the determination of desirability to amend as requested by the public. So that the process is pretty much on track in our view. So we are almost completing. Today we've done 20 pets, right? We've completed 20 legal opinions. I think we've asked about 28-30 opinions after we've assessed those submissions, and we felt we needed some easy reference legally and policy-wise. So we are still on track. Hopefully we will complete this process of engaging the legal opinions just to clarify ourselves and prepare ourselves for deliberations that will ensue after these legal opinions have been presented. Honourable Swart?
Chair, I'd just like to thank the legal advisors. This is incredibly hard work, and they've got a massive amount of pressure. And just from our side, to thank them for this very in-depth legal opinions that they've given. It really helps us with our work that we have to do when we deliberate on these issues.
Thank you. Honourable Mwabe?
Thank you, Chair. No, on your comment, I really respect the position of the committee chair. It's just an appetite of engagement of issues as a young politician. Thank you.
Great, good. Honourable Members, Dr. Abdulhadi Majake?
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to take the opportunity of thanking the legal advisors for the job well done. Quite extensive work. We appreciate it. Thanks.
Good. On that high note, honourable members and colleagues from the administration, legal office, secretariat, we thank you for this session of today. It was very fruitful, and I think we learned a lot as well. It was really, really educative as well, beyond just the call of legal opinions that we requested. So I thank you all, and we hope to schedule one meeting before we rise next week. we will find a slot and you will be duly notified, probably because we told NA sitting as early as 10 o'clock next Thursday. So the indication that we might look for a slot for Wednesday, isn't it that? But members, you will be duly informed and notified if there's any slots that we found. We then thank you, and the meeting is adjourned. Oh, corner, so that's really another house.